and welcome to our Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, Dr. Keith Klosterman, marriage and family therapist and core faculty member in the Clinical Mental Health Counseling Program at Walden University. Welcome.
Thank you, Laura. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, these are some scary times, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Children and families are dealing with a lot of news, and they are probably having some trouble processing what they're hearing. Kids are inundated with a lot of information that they have to filter through. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, you know, Laura, I think that, geez, even prior to the pandemic, you know, I think the demands on kids, children, adolescents, families, you know, things are so much different now in terms of increased use of technology, academic standards, kids being really forced to figure out what they want to do with their lives at young ages. And I used to feel like it was so much. And there was lots of anxiety and depression prior to the pandemic. And then the pandemic hit. And I think it really threw kids a loop. You know, for many of them, I think because of stay-at-home orders, social distancing, you know, the traditional sort of coping mechanisms, whether that was sports, hanging out with friends, were stripped away. And for many of kids, they were sort of left wondering, well, what now? You know, and feeling really disconnected, really alone. I know a lot of the PSAs, you know, they spoke about the value of, well, there's this increased family time. You know, you could spend more time with your family, play games. It was sort of this romanticized version. But for many kids, more time at home with their family wasn't necessarily the best thing, you know, and school provided an outlet and support and structure that wasn't really available for them at home. So I think like the pandemic was really challenging on kids' mental health. We saw increases in depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, even hospital visits, ER visits for suicide. And I think more recently with, you know, the conflict in Ukraine, you know, I think it's hard for kids to wrap around and what that means. And with the school shootings, you know, active shooter drills, I just think it's so complicated now. And kids are facing issues that many of us never had to deal with.
I was going to say, it is such a different world. A generation before me grew up with duck and cover. The idea of nuclear obliteration was always in the back of your mind. And yet we don't talk about that now. People of a certain age never say, well, I grew up with this and now today I'm having these issues. Is it social media? Is it more access to information that's making the difference?
I think so. You know, I would say that with the 24-hour news cycles, even through social media news feeds, and depending on the sourcing of it, the information may not be entirely accurate. So I do think that kids are exposed to things at earlier ages that other generations have never had to deal with. And oftentimes, they're exposed to these things, but don't have the resources to fully understand whether or not it's accurate and what it actually means for them. So they're left to sort of figure it out on their own or through their peers, which often isn't the best way to do that.
When we talk about disasters or we talk about war, and we're talking about obviously school shootings right now, which prompted this conversation today, but yet kids have always faced the monsters under the closet. They've always known that there's a lighted match away from my family house going up in flames, or what if my parents were to die? So anxiety and fear is not just something brand new. Is it just more intensified, or have we just not been paying enough attention to those monsters that they've been facing all along?
I think it's a little bit of both, really. You know, I think you're right. Anxiety, fear, depression, they've always been there. I think we are more aware of it now. We're more aware of the impact that it has on kids socially, academically, and we're better able to identify and to treat it. So I think there's that piece for the increase in numbers. I also think that, you know, it's when you see these scenes on the news, with whether it's a school shooting or, you know, war in Ukraine, it kind of drives it home, especially when kids are already doing active shooter drills. You know, I think when you see your peer group on the news and you hear the things that are being said, and again, the news, you know, I think sometimes kids are exposed to more news than they need to be. and especially at certain developmental ages. I don't know that it's healthy, but you know, what I'd say to that is I think it's twofold. I think one is the access piece, which is, you know, everyone in kids are gaining access to technology at younger and younger ages. So they are exposed to it, whether we like it or not. I also think that we are better at identifying kids that are struggling. But having said that, the challenge is we identify these kids and there's not a whole lot of resources and supports. So I think that, you know, it's through the result of whether it's the school shootings, the pandemic, war, famine, other disasters, I think it's forcing us to look at child and adolescent mental health and the way we treat kids. And also, what are the resources and supports necessary for them and their families?
Well, a lot of this conversation will have to be about the family, because you can't say, oh, one person is struggling or one generation is having an issue. When you're living in the same household, it's family mental health that we're really going to have to address here.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that depending on the family dynamic, you know, I often see kids who come in for a visit. The parents, the child is the identified patient, if you will. But when you see the larger system and what's going on in that, you know, you realize that the child's behavior is symptomatic. And oftentimes the child may be the most well-adjusted member of the family, even though he or she is the one that brought the family into treatment. I think that, you know, with a parent, the way a parent handles their feelings around, you know, what's happening, these disasters in the world, these shootings, I think that has implications for their child as well. I think being willing to talk about some of these things for many families, depending on their culture, their value system, maybe they don't talk about feelings, right? How many times have you heard people, maybe in your own circle of friends, well, we don't talk about that stuff in my family. You know, we don't talk about feelings, or feelings are soft. And so I think that's another, you know, layer to this in terms of helping kids. Oftentimes, maybe they don't have that at home.
Well, you can't start any conversation or start worrying about your child unless you know where you are at that time. If you're in hysterics, or if you are in a state of heightened anxiety because of what is happening, how do you calmly talk to a child? You can't, can you?
No, you really can't. And kids are like sponges, right? They pick up on what's happening for their parents and the way they're dealing with it. And that's what they learn. That's what they know. We're all products of our environment. And I think, you know, for many parents, the way their parents treated them is what they know. And that's what they do with their kids. And I'll often say to a parent, you know, when things aren't going well, we'll talk about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And they'll say, well, my parents did this to me and I turned out okay. Well, maybe not so much, right? It's a different era. It's a different time. And so sometimes parents are doing the best they can with what they know. It's just not working, or it's not helpful for their child, and they don't see it.
Yeah, this is completely out of left field. But something you just said, well, I'm doing okay. Well, a lot of people do get along well. They can exist. They're 9 to 5. They go home, and barring a situation that brings something to a head, they're doing quite well coping. But maybe they don't realize that they have issues. I mean, what are some of the signs in an adult? Or do you even worry about that? And you just say, here's what we're doing going forward. There was a question in there.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, I think it's a good one. I think your point is, many adults are surviving, right? And they're getting through the day, and there may not be the insight or awareness that, hey, things could be better, right? Or maybe I'm not doing as well as I think I am, and it could possibly be impacting my family. You know, I think there has to be a willingness to, A, reflect on how you're really doing, and then also notice how the people around you are responding to you. You know, people are part of systems. And I think oftentimes the way that we identify something's not going well for us is how the other people in our system are responding. So maybe there's increased problems at work. Maybe there's increased family tension or struggle, right? Just general unhappiness, changes in eating and sleeping patterns. Those are all signs, right? In and of themselves, it's not anything that we'd say, well, this person's struggling. But when you start to layer them together, it begins to paint a picture.
So this is not a sprint. This is a long, steady walk. And it really could begin today with a little self-evaluation, a little self-study and introspect. And then what do we do then? What do we say when suddenly we realize that, you know what, maybe I'm not as close to these people as I used to be. Maybe I'm not as happy at my job or with my children as I used to be. What are the steps one takes?
Well, I think it depends. You know, I think talking to a therapist can be really helpful, right? And again, of course, I'm biased because that's what I do. But what I'd say is having an objective person to sort of just bounce what's happening for you off of that person to see, you know, is there another way of looking at this? So much of what the way we interact in life is through awareness, you know, and create, and maybe by seeing a therapist, you create a new awareness for yourself of things that you've been doing that haven't really been productive. Maybe patterns begin to emerge. You begin to look at things differently. So a therapist is one option. I think if you have supportive people in your life, whether that's family, whether that's friends, being willing to have the conversation, I think that's the first step, you know, to being willing to say, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure how I'm doing, or I've been feeling off the last however many months. I think that's where you start, you know, and then depending on the severity of it or what you think needs to happen, you go from there.
Well, this conversation was, again, prompted by the most recent school shootings. Isn't that terrible? I'm saying the most recent school shootings. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily shootings in a school that a child is going to be afraid of. Are you afraid of going to a mall now? Are you scared to be standing on the street corner or on your step? Do you worry about a bullet coming through the front door? But when a crisis does occur and you do have to have a conversation with your child, you want to be as prepared as possible. How do we get ready before we say, and again, what are the opening words to that conversation? But how do we process and get ready to talk to our children?
I think that part of it is we have to be willing to be honest about how we feel, right? Parents often believe that they can't share their feelings with their kids, that they have to be strong. I think sometimes letting kids into where we're at gives them permission to share their feelings as well, right? Something terrible happened today. This is how I feel about it. You know, how are you feeling? So I think that's a really important step. I also think that parents can really benefit by listening first, right? Allowing the child or adolescent to share his or her perceptions of the events. People see things differently, right? So allowing them to share how they feel without interruption, right? Without dismissing their feelings or telling them you shouldn't feel that way, you know, and having your full attention. And I think that sounds sort of, well, duh, right? I also think that especially today with cell phones and other forms of technology, oftentimes we spend so much of our time distracted, even during these important conversations. So I think if you're going to have that conversation, the child or adolescent should have your undivided attention. I think that's really important. I think validating their feelings is also critical, right? Of course you'd feel that way. You don't want to tell them that their feelings are necessarily wrong, but I think it's okay to say, well, it must be really hard to feel both sad and scared. Of course you're anxious about going to school. Right. Of course they would be. They see these things on the news. They see these kids being, you know, running out of the building, you know, but also letting the child know that you, as a parent and someone who loves and cares about them, you're there for them. You know, one of the last things I'd say about that is I think it's important to provide reassurance, and reassurance in the sense of, look, the people that love you and care about you, the other grownups in your life, are doing everything they can to protect you, you know, whether, and that's members of the community, members of school, and that it's a priority to make sure that they're safe and protected. But also being aware of social media, right? And what, as best you can, you know, what kinds of social media kids are using and what information they're looking at can be really important as well.
You said if you have this conversation, do we need to force the conversation? Do we take cues and wait for the kids to say something? Or do we, when we have processed, know what we're feeling, bring it up at the dinner table or in the car ride home one day?
You know, I think you have to read the room and meet kids where they're at. I think sometimes expressing an openness and a willingness to have the conversation and to model what you would hope to get from the kids is a place to start. And I often think, especially with kids, sometimes they're trying to make sense of it too, and they may not be ready to share what they think with their parents. But it may, maybe it's not that night, but maybe another night or a few nights later, the kid opens up and says, well, yeah, I've really been struggling with this. So I think, you know, rather than waiting for the child or the adolescent to say, well, I'm having a hard time, I think creating a climate where it's okay and it's safe to do that and gently checking in about how they're doing and letting them know, look, if there's something bothering you or things that, you know, I can help you with, I want to help.
Does that help prepare them for the next big disaster or occurrence that could rock their world? I mean, does that set the stage for them being better able to process or address their fears? And I hate to say it again, the next time they hear about a shooting or there's a fire that takes out hundreds of homes or people are being displaced.
Well, yeah, I think that would be the goal. Right, that the kids can turn toward their families, right, or supportive people in their life for support, that they know that it's okay to say, I'm scared. It's okay to say, I'm anxious about going to school, and that they've got someone there. And it's not necessarily that the important people in their life can fix that, right, but they can support them and let them know and validate their feelings. So I think like the goal would be that maybe this is another resource. Maybe it's the only resource kids have. Kids are notorious for going sort of underground with their feelings. And they don't say anything, right? And then it builds up and it builds up and it builds up. And essentially what happens is they end up suffering in silence. They don't say anything to anyone. And then you notice changes in academics. They start to withdraw from their friends, you know? So I think like letting them know it's okay and that you want to help, right? Whether it's at that time or when they're ready to talk about it, can be really helpful. And hopefully it can become a resource that they have, as you said, Laura, when the next situation happens.
You alluded to suicidal thoughts before. Mm-hmm. Are the symptoms and signs for both anxiety and possible self-harm, are they similar? What should we be looking for?
So anxiety or depression aren't necessarily predictors of suicide, let's say. And what I mean by that is lots of people are depressed, but not everyone who's depressed is suicidal. So it can be a component of that, right? So what I'd say to that is if you notice that a child is increasingly depressed, you know, there's changes in the way he or she is functioning at school, changes with friends, withdrawal at home, isolation, not sleeping like he or she used to, right? Appetite is gone. Those are all red flags, right? So when you start to stack those up, and then if you layer in, let's say, a previous suicide attempt, maybe a family history of suicide, that heightens it even more. So I think like when you get this preponderance of symptoms, right, of risk factors, that's when you want to be assessing for suicide and for safety.
If you do have concerns, what are the steps you should take? And are there exercises or practices that we should be doing daily to promote our mental health and try to stave off an overreaction or an extreme reaction to what occurs around us?
Yeah. So I'll take the first part first, which was, so what do you do about it? Right. Isn't that always the question? So you're worried about somebody. The best thing you can do is ask. And I know it's the best thing you can do. It's often the hardest thing and the most uncomfortable thing for people to do, right. To specifically ask, are you thinking of hurting yourself? You know, are you thinking about suicide? In general, most people who are suicidal they'll tell you how they're feeling. They will let you in. They don't want to. It's not that someone wants to die necessarily. It's just that someone's in pain and despair and has run out of options. That's what it basically comes down to. So being willing to ask, you know, are you okay? Are you feeling like hurting yourself? I think that's the first step. Then I think, you know, getting professional help is key. So you know, if it's at school and it's a teacher who has the kid, getting the social worker or school counselor, or school psychologist, right? There's also agencies within the community. Like in our community, we have crisis services. They can come out and do outreach assessments where they would assess the person for their level of lethality. And if the person was high enough and at risk, they could have them transported to the hospital for psychiatric evaluation, right? Which is, if someone's at imminent risk of suicide, that's where they should be, right? Because they'll be safe. So I think we always want to make sure that people are safe first and foremost, and then we want to get them to the right level of care.
Of course, we know, anyone listening to this show knows that you can always text to 741-741 for a counselor who is trained in suicide prevention. 741-741 will always get you immediate help. And you can actually text before you sit down and ask the question so that you are ready. But again, that's 741-741, wherever you may be hearing this. I've heard of parents who have gone online and purchased the book bags that have the backpacks that have the bulletproof protection panel, getting cell phones for their kids and telling them how to call. And you mentioned the active shooter drills. Do these measures help or hinder? I mean, an active shooter drill, it is a proactive thing, just like having that plan in case of fire in the middle of the night, knowing where you're going to meet afterwards. Reassurance versus alarmism. Is there a fine line there? And what are some of the don'ts we should be doing right now?
Well, that's a great question. I do want to circle back just really quickly and add one more thing on the suicide discussion. I think what my advice would be to always err on the side of caution. You know, sometimes you'll hear people say that, well, they're just looking for attention. And especially parents. You know, I think it's really important that if you're worried about your daughter or your son's mental health or well-being, if there's a thought that, you know, maybe this is going on, I always say ask, always ask. And if you're unsure or if the child's unsure, get help. But what you don't want to do is take that chance and, you know, heaven forbid something ever happens. So if you're not sure, always ask, right? And if you don't know how to ask, find somebody who can. So I just want to be really clear about that. I think, you know, the difference in terms of, you know, some of the things we're doing, you know, whether it's the backpacks or active shooter drills, I think we're all trying to figure it out now. You know, what's the best way to do this? And I don't know if we truly understand as a society what the lasting implications of this will be. If any, I think it's good to be proactive in terms of, well, what do we do in the event that this happens? We're seeing an uptick in terms of the frequency of these events. So I think it's good to be prepared. At what point you draw the line where it becomes a little much or over the top? I don't know. You know, I think that's a personal and a family decision. Sending your child to school worrying that his or her school could be next is a terrible feeling. So, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's necessary. I don't know if in the process of doing that, you're sort of creating anxiety. I think it's really hard to say, and we won't know the implications until more study is done.
Well, then I'm circling back to a question that I kind of lost track of. Are there daily practices? Is there anything we can do to keep us as resilient as possible in preparation for our next disaster?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up again. I think, you know, one thing is we have to have balance. It can't all be doom and gloom, you know. And I guess what I mean by that is being careful about, whether it's through social media or the news, you know, what our consumption is and what consumption is going on in the home, especially since in the conversations, I'd say, because kids are sponges. Right. But I think even for adults, making sure, yes, we want to be informed, but we also don't want to go so far into it that we lose sight of the bigger picture. You know, I think we also have to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves, you know, whether that's through activities for adults. exercise, whether it's sports or hanging out with friends for kids. I think there has to be a balance on that. Otherwise, it's very easy to get saturated, you know, with all the negativity around this. I want to be clear. I'm not proposing that we're Pollyanna. That's not it at all. I think we have to have a realistic approach to it, but we also have to live our lives and we have to make sure that we're doing okay mentally and that we're doing everything within our power to take care of ourselves. And sometimes that's all we can do.
I'm giving you the 2-minute warning, parting words. What's the takeaway?
You know, I think the takeaway, there's two. One is I think that we need more enhanced mental health services for families. And I think whether that's in schools, I think that in schools we have to look at how do we provide more comprehensive services to families, whether that's in the form of family therapy, whether that's in the form of resources, supports beyond just, you know, the traditional way of handling mental health in schools or making a referral into the community. So I think knowing that there's increased anxiety and depression, we have to get serious about treating that beyond go talk to somebody for a class period and then go back to class. I think the other piece for families more directly is to be able to talk to kids about how they're feeling, to have honest conversations. Again, developmentally appropriate, of course, but I think we have to begin to understand what's going on for these kids given the current challenges that they face. I think our challenge as a society is that oftentimes families aren't equipped to do that, right? And some families, for better or for worse, just those conversations are never going to occur. And that's why I think the high touch point areas, whether it's schools, pediatricians, whoever it may be, have to be willing to serve that role if needed for some of these kids. Otherwise, that's when they fall through the cracks.
So it might not be a parent-child conversation. It could be a teacher-student. It could be during the checkup, or it could be after choir practice.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that, you know, because we have to be realistic. In a perfect world, all families would be able to do this. We know that that's not always going to be the case. And sometimes a kid can be open and transparent with a parent, and the parent may not know what to do with it or may not want to talk about it. So I think we have to find other institutions within these kids' lives to support them and to also recognize when the kid may need our help.
Where would you send us for more information?
The Child Mind Institute has lots of really good information, not just about child and adolescent mental health, but also like tips and strategies for families and for parents. I think it's a great resource. And they do have a newsletter that they send out periodically. And I think it's got lots of really good information on it.
Thank you for doing this today.
Oh, my pleasure. It's such an important topic, especially now, given everything happening, not only in our country and the world. And I think, you know, we really do need to consider new paradigms for helping kids and supporting kids as they transition into adulthood. You know, I don't think it's coincidence that we see so many kids that they're on the verge of adulthood and they're saying, well, I don't like what adulthood has to offer, right? Or there's nothing there for me. And they end up in crisis. So I think as a society, we have to do a better job of supporting these kids early on.
And with social media, with the 24-hour news cycles around the world, it's no longer around the world. It's in your pocket. It's in your living room. It's everywhere. And for more information, Dr. Klosterman does recommend the Child Mind Institute. They're easy to find. Go to childmind.org. That's childmind.org. Always remember, before you have that tough conversation, or if you are dealing with a crisis situation, you can always text to 741-741. You will get resources wherever you happen to be at that time from a live person on the other side. 741-741. My guest today, Dr. Keith Klosterman, marriage and family therapist and core faculty member in the Clinical Mental Health Counseling Program at Walden University. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Laura. I really enjoyed the conversation and the opportunity to talk about this topic.
And I did too. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Our Delaware Valley.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.